Once you've cleaned out and repaired your body's food processing and waste removal system, as we've discussed in the previous talks, you're ready to begin the process of rebuilding your body. Keep in mind, though, your body is rebuilding itself all the time. The actual life cycle of a blood cell, for example, is approximately 4 months. That means you end up replacing your entire blood supply every 120 days. The question is, what will determine the quality of that blood? What are you going to be building that new blood from? Cocoa Puffs and beer? Understand, it's not only your blood, but every cell and organ in your body that's being replaced. For the most part, you get an entirely new body every 7 years. It doesn't take a genius to realize that the better your nutrition, the better quality new body you're going to have. Unfortunately, it's not quite that simple. Any attempt to optimize the nutrition we take into our bodies must address 5 key problem areas. First, we need to deal with the question of meat. Do you eat it or not? Then there's the question of milk. Does it really do a body good? Third problem area is fats, particularly plastic fats. Another question we have to deal with is the issue of refined processed foods. And then finally, we need to touch on the whole organic thing, although we'll cover that in more detail in the next talk. Well, let's just go right for it and upset as many people as we can. Let's start by talking about the issue of meat and high and low protein diets. Probably no topic has been more discussed and is more confusing than what constitutes the optimum diet. There's the caveman diet, the blood type diet, the high-carbo diet, the low-carbo diet, the high-protein diet, the low-protein diet, the steak lover's diet, the vegetarian diet, the vegan or pure vegetarian diet, the Hollywood diet, the Scarsdale diet, the Twinkie diet, and on and on and on and on. Heck, I get confused just as I say it all. So let's step back and take an objective view of the situation and do a little reality check here. Let's begin by cutting through all of the nonsense and just taking a look at what kinds of food our bodies were designed to handle, and then figure out what that means for us today. And the best way to do that is by first identifying the key characteristics of our eating and digestive systems, then seeing which animals we match up with and what they eat. And the reason animals are a great test is because they're not governed by social considerations. They eat what they need to eat. The key indicators that we're going to look at are the teeth, the stomach, and the length of the digestive tract. For reference, let's start by looking at ourselves, the human eating machine. First, human teeth. All of our teeth are nearly of the same height, our canines are projected only a small amount, and our molars are broad-topped. As for our stomachs, the human stomach is slightly elongated, approximating the shape of a kidney bean. And finally, our digestive tracts. The average adult has a digestive tract measured from mouth to anus of about 30 to 33 feet long. This means that the ratio of the length of a person's digestive tract as compared to their height, which is also measured from mouth to anus, is approximately 10 to 12 times the length of their body. Now, why am I measuring height from mouth to anus and not from head to toe? Quite simply, so we can compare apples to apples. Since every animal other than man walks on all fours, we measure their size from nose to butt. We don't stretch out their hind legs and add that to their height for the purposes of calculation. So to get a valid comparison, we need to use the same standard when measuring our own height. Anyway, now that we have ourselves as a reference, let's take a quick look at the animal kingdom. Let's start by taking a look at the carnivores, the meat-eaters, lions, tigers, etc. First thing you notice about carnivores is their teeth are nothing like those found in humans. They have huge canines for striking and seizing prey, pointed incisors for removing meat from bones, and molars and premolars with cusps for shredding muscle fiber. In carnivores, the teeth of the upper jaw slide past the outside of the lower jaw, so that the prey is caught in a vice-like grip. In general, carnivores don't chew much. Mostly they just tear chunks off and swallow them whole. Now, an examination of the carnivore intestinal tract reveals a short, relative to the length of their body, bowel for fast transit of waste out of the body. The actual length of the carnivore bowel is approximately 3 to 5 times the length of the body, a ratio less than half that found in humans. This short bowel provides fast transit of waste for carnivores, which is important for 2 reasons. One, the faster the transit, the less opportunity for parasites in that meat to take hold. And two, meat tends to putrefy in the intestinal tract. Fast transit, therefore, limits exposure to the byproducts of putrefaction. Carnivore stomach is also different. Unlike humans, most of the digestive process occurs in the carnivore stomach, which is a round, sack-shaped, simple structure with a very high concentration of acid salts for digesting animal muscle and bone. Food usually remains for days at a time in a carnivore stomach, while it's digested to a large extent by enzymes present in the raw meat itself, a process called autolytic digestion. In addition, carnivores are adapted to process huge amounts of food at a time, up to 25% of their body weight or more. That'd be like a person eating 40, 50 pounds of food at a time. But that's what carnivores do. They eat this huge amount of food, then eat nothing for days at a time. Again, this doesn't sound very much like us. For our next animal group, let's take a look at the herbivores, the plant eaters, cows and deers, etc. Well, herbivores have sharp, chisel-shaped incisors for cutting plant matter. They have no upper incisors, in some cases, and small incisor-like canines. Their diastema molars and premolars are flattened with ridges. Their teeth and upper jaw meet the lower jaw end on end so that the lateral movement of the lower jaw produces the grinding actions to break down plant materials. In herbivores, the incisors are dominant, the canines usually depressed, and the molars broad-topped. As for the herbivore bowel, it usually runs almost 8 times longer than a carnivore's, 20 to 28 times the length of the body, since unlike meat, plant matter is not prone to putrefaction, thus rendering quick elimination moot. Herbivores also tend to have extended, compound stomachs. Again, not much like us. So what about the omnivores, those eaters of roots, berries, meat, whatever? In this group, we find bears and wild pigs and the like. In truth, no animal is really adapted to eat all things, but if any animal comes close, it would have to be the bear. Typical foods consumed by bears include ants, bees, seeds, roots, nuts, berries, insect larvae such as grubs, and even flowers. Some meat, of course, is eaten by bears, including rodents, fish, deer, pigs, and lambs. Grizzlies and Alaskan brown bears are well-known salmon eaters. Polar bears feed almost exclusively on seals and on an occasional human. But then what vegetation is there for them to eat in the frozen wastes of the Arctic? And of course, anyone who has read Winnie the Pooh knows that bears love honey. All of this means that other than the ants and grubs and rodents, the bear diet sounds a lot like the typical American diet. And it's for this reason that many people conclude that the natural human diet is that of an omnivore. But remember, we're stepping back and taking a look physiologically where we fit in. And on those counts, we don't match the omnivores. The biggest difference is in the teeth. Omnivores have the sharp canines of the carnivore and the pronounced incisors of the herbivores. They also have molars that are both pointed and broad-topped. That's not even close to a human set of teeth. Finally, there are the frugivores, the fruit and nut eaters, the gorillas and chimps, etc. In the frugivore, all the teeth are nearly of the same height. The canines are little projected and the molars are broad-topped. Sound familiar? Unlike the carnivore jaw, which as we've seen is vertically mobile for biting or tearing, the jaw of the typical frugivore is laterally mobile to allow for chewing. As for the bowel of the frugivore, it runs about 10 to 12 times the length of the body from mouth to anus, the same as found in the human body. The stomach of the frugivore is typically long and extended, a complex structure containing 1/10 of the acidic salts and pepsin found in a carnivore stomach, again, the same as in us. So here we have our match. But what does it mean? Are we restricted to fruits and nuts? No. In fact, the frugivores we most closely resemble, the wild chimpanzees, periodically do eat live insects and raw meat. Among the great apes, which includes the gorilla, the orangutan, the bonobo, and the chimpanzee, and ourselves, only humans and chimpanzees hunt and eat meat on a frequent basis. Wild chimps love fresh baby monkey meat, but make no mistake, chimpanzees are largely fruit eaters, and meat comprises only about 3% of their diet. Far, far less than is found in the typical American diet. So should we or should we not eat meat? Is a vegetarian diet automatically better? No. In fact, depending on blood type, some people actually do better when they include meat in their diet. Other factors in our diet affect our health to a much greater degree than whether or not we eat meat. So the bottom line is that eating small amounts of meat, chicken, or fish probably comes down mostly to a personal choice. If you choose to, you can eat 3 ounces a day or less of meat without any significant health problems with the following provisos. 1. Keep the amount small, 3 ounces a day or less. Heavy consumption of meat significantly compromises beneficial bacteria in the colon, resulting in a 1,000% increase in the levels of harmful bacteria in the colon and a concomitant 90% drop in the levels of beneficial bacteria as measured in fecal matter. High consumption of meat also tends to push the body's pH levels into the acidic range, which, as we'll cover in a future talk, presents major health risks, including cancer and osteoporosis. In addition, epidemiological studies at Harvard Medical School showed that men who eat red meat as a main dish 5 or more times a week have 4 times the risk of colon cancer than men who eat red meat less than once a month. They're also more than twice as likely to get prostate cancer. The bottom line on meat, then, is that if you're going to eat meat, Buy only organic meat to avoid exposure to the whole range of chemicals, growth hormones, and parasites present in beef and chicken. Just as an example, over 90% of today's chickens are fed arsenic compounds, and while we're on the subject of chickens, it's probably worth mentioning that according to a government study, over 90% of the chickens sold in this country are infected with leucosis. That's chicken cancer. As for those chickens with too much cancerous tissue to be sold, well, they're destroyed, then ground up and fed back to the chickens that we ultimately buy and eat. As for fish, you have to watch out for the high levels of toxic metals present in most fish. Where can you get organic meat? Well, if it isn't available locally, pressure your supermarket to carry it as an option. Now that's it for meat. Which brings us to our second problem area. What about dairy? The average American typically eats close to 600 pounds of dairy products a year, which makes it the single largest component of our diet. Unfortunately, this may not be as healthy as the milk ads you see on TV would lead you to believe. Even if the cow's milk you get is free of chemicals, growth hormones, allergenic proteins, blood, pus, antibiotics, bacteria, and viruses typically found in milk, you still have major problems. Cow's milk is not designed for people. For one thing, it has 20 times the casein of human milk. These high levels of casein are just one of several reasons that humans do not digest milk proteins very well. This can lead to numerous allergic reactions and high levels of mucus in our noses and bowels. Incidentally, Elmer's glue is made from cow's milk casein. That's why you see Elsie the cow in each bottle of Elmer's glue. Think of it this way. Human milk is designed to take an infant from 8 pounds to 40 pounds in 18 months. Cow's milk is designed to take a calf from 90 pounds to 1,000 pounds in about 24 months. Although they are both white, mother's milk and cow's milk are totally different beverages. And for that matter, the cow's milk you buy in the store and the cow's milk that comes from a cow are not necessarily similar substances. First, homogenized milk is not natural and may very well present serious health risks. The theory behind homogenization sounds simple. Break up the fat particles in milk until they're so small that they stay suspended in the milk and don't rise to the top and form the layer of cream that used to be the trademark of all bottles of milk. Unfortunately, there's a side effect to this process. Once you make the fat particles so small that they don't rise, you've also made them so small that they easily get absorbed into the body, potentially clogging your arteries. Second, there's the problem of the growth hormone used in dairy cows to increase milk production. This growth hormone, called bovine somatotropin, BST, was developed by Monsanto. It was supposed to be identical to the actual growth hormone found in cows, and in fact, as part of their 55,000-page application to the FDA, Monsanto submitted a chart identifying the 191 amino acids contained in BST, showing that they absolutely matched the amino acid chain found in natural growth hormone. Unfortunately, this application may be inaccurate. The problem seems to occur at amino acid number 144, which was supposed to be lysine in both the natural growth hormone and in Monsanto's BST. As it turns out, there's a question. In the July 1994 issue of Protein Science, Bernard Violand, a Monsanto scientist, published evidence that amino acid number 144 in Monsanto's growth hormone is in fact epsilon N-acetyllysine, a freak substance. Whoops. Anyway, the FDA gave its approval for the sale of Monsanto's BST product back in 1993, but in Canada and the European Union, BST remains unapproved because of the strong circumstantial evidence that it may promote cancer in cows and humans. Understand, this change in one amino acid is not insignificant. The replacement of one amino acid can change the configuration of a protein significantly, and configuration determines the properties and effects of a protein. Another factor to consider concerning the high consumption of dairy is that the body digests milk, any milk, differently once gastric juices begin to flow at around 18 to 20 months old. Before gastric juices flow, milk is alkaline and non-mucus forming in the body. But once gastric juices enter the picture, they turn the milk acid, forming mucus, causing sinus problems, allergies, colds, etc. That's why every animal except man weans its young off milk. Think about that for a moment. In addition to all of that, milk has been implicated in heart disease. If you do drink milk, it's essential that you take a folic acid supplement to neutralize the xanthine oxidase found in milk. Xanthine oxidase, which attacks the arteries, is a major factor in heart disease. Interestingly enough, this problem seems to occur only with homogenized milk. When non-homogenized milk is consumed, the body excretes the xanthine oxidase. Milk has also been implicated in cancer, particularly breast cancer. Just as a side note, it's probably worth noting that 60% of America's dairy cows are infected with a leukemia virus. Then there's diabetes. One particular protein, beta-casein, found in cow's milk, can literally trick the immune system into attacking and destroying the insulin-producing beta cells of the pancreas. Bottom line here is that there's strong statistical correlation between high dairy consumption and high diabetes rates. Keep in mind that the incidence of diabetes has in fact doubled in just the last 5 years in the United States. Another factor, in addition to everything we've mentioned so far, is the high mucus-forming potential of dairy implicated in both allergies and colds. And dairy has also been implicated in colitis and in colic and earaches in young children. And finally, milk has played a major role in the development of the superbacteria that have recently emerged to plague our health. How? In 1990, the USDA allowed the dairy industry to increase the antibiotic residue standard for milk by 10,000%. The problem is that at this level of constant intake, the antibiotics destroy the probiotic colonies normally found in the intestinal tract, which then allows harmful bacteria to flourish and develop resistance to a whole range of antibiotics. Just as a note, there are 52 different kinds of antibiotics and 59 bioactive hormones found in milk. The bottom line is that if you must have dairy, use organic. Avoid homogenized milk at all costs. Also, there are a number of grain and rice-based milk alternatives, some of which taste spectacular. Ah, yes, milk is often pitched as a great source of calcium. Not so. Yes, it has a high calcium content, but the body is able to utilize very little of it. And in fact, because of the way your body deals with milk, consumption of milk may actually leach calcium from the bones. If you have any doubt about this, just consider the fact that Americans are among the highest consumers of dairy in the world, eating an average of 600 pounds of dairy a year per person, and yet we have one of the highest incidences of osteoporosis in the civilized world. No, it's a myth that we need milk for calcium. There are many far superior sources of calcium, such as sesame seeds. The problem with milk is that because of its high acidity, your body needs to buffer it with even more internal calcium than you get from the milk itself. And now on to our next dietary problem, the number one dietary problem, in fact, unnatural fats. Food manufacturers love hydrogenated oils because hydrogenation makes oils thicker, creamier, and more appetizing to the consumer. Unfortunately, hydrogenation also saturates the oil's fatty acids, changing them into trans fatty acids. Trans fatty acids are the number one killer in our diets and a major contributor to cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. Hydrogenated and partially hydrogenated oils are absolutely unnecessary and have no place in your diet or in any of the foods you eat. The number one dietary prescription from this talk is to totally eliminate all hydrogenated oils from your diet. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as it sounds. Food manufacturers have put them in almost every food they manufacture. The good news is that if enough people refuse to buy foods that contain trans fatty acid oils, manufacturers will stop putting them in their foods. You also want to eliminate refined oils and manufactured polyunsaturated oils from your diet. What oils are good? Virtually any raw, natural oil is good. Olive oil is great. Use lots of extra virgin olive oil in your cooking. Surprisingly, butter is cool, provided that you can get butter that doesn't contain antibiotics and bovine growth hormone and all the rest of the nonsense that many dairy farmers use. Wait a second. Isn't butter high in saturated fat? Absolutely, and let's put that bugaboo to rest. Natural saturated fats in moderation are not a problem. They do not raise cholesterol levels. They do not lead to heart disease. In fact, there's actually a group of very popular diets right now that help people lose weight and lower cholesterol levels while eating as much meat and eggs and natural saturated fat as they like. The two reasons these diets work are, one, natural saturated fats do not cause heart problems, and two, all versions of this diet call for the elimination of snack foods, processed foods, sugar foods, foods containing any trans fatty acids, and foods high in the glycemic index. Now, I'm not recommending these diets. I've already discussed my concerns with too much meat in the diet. Nevertheless, these programs do demonstrate the health-building power of just eliminating the bad things from our diet. Now, we can call our next dietary problem the number two dietary problem. I'm talking about refined carbohydrates. This includes all refined and processed foods, including everything made from white flour, white rice, cold cereals, most hot cereals, most snack foods, all sugar foods, including cakes, candies, and soda pop. And by the way, soda pop, particularly colas, may be the single worst food ever invented. First soda contains approximately 1 teaspoon of sugar per ounce of soda. Aspartame is even worse, once having been considered by the military for possible use as a battlefield neurotoxin. But anyway, in terms of sugar, it works out to about 12 teaspoons per can or 32 teaspoons per big gulp. In addition, many sodas, particularly colas, are high in phosphoric acid, which leaches calcium out of your body at an astounding rate. and also does feature CO2 bubbles, which, when you think about it, are the body's main waste product. In summary, refined carbohydrates negatively affect the body in a number of ways. They're all acid-forming in the body, which we'll talk about more in a subsequent talk, and they're all converted to triglycerides in the body and stored as fat. And they all rank high in the glycemic index with no redeeming nutritional value, such as the fruits and vegetables that are also high in the glycemic index. So let's talk about the glycemic index. The glycemic index and identifying high glycemic foods is one of the hot areas of nutritional science right now. Not to make light of it, it is an extremely important dietary consideration, but with one big however. First, though, a quick discussion of the glycemic index. Diabetics have been using the glycemic index for years to help in controlling their insulin levels. Quite simply, foods that adversely affect blood sugar by elevating insulin levels are termed high glycemic foods, and foods that do not elevate insulin levels are low glycemic. High glycemic foods can cause your body to store fat, make you fatigued, cause your brain to go fuzzy, lead to heart problems such as elevated LDL cholesterol levels and high blood pressure. Obviously, these are conditions to be avoided. High glycemic foods that cause elevated insulin levels and the concomitant problems I just mentioned include, well, the fruits such as bananas, raisins, carrots, potatoes, and corn, but more notably, breads, cereals, pastas, and rice of all kinds, virtually all snack foods, sugars of all kinds, and soda pop. Now, earlier I mentioned that there was a big however to the glycemic index. What is that however? It's called chewing. If you chew your food well enough, the saliva neutralizes much of the glycemic response. So how much do you need to chew your food? There's an old saying that goes, you should drink your solids and chew your liquids. What that means is that you should chew the dry food you eat until it turns to liquid in your mouth, about 40 chews per mouthful, and that you should swish liquids back and forth in your mouth, chew them, as it were, an equal number of times. Literally, if you're chewing your food properly, you should be consuming about a cup and a half of saliva with every meal. Now, I'm not talking in a separate glass, but literally by mixing it with your food. This is what helps neutralize the glycemic response when you eat. Now, as we've already discussed when we talked about refined foods, you should give up snack foods and refined flour products and sugar-sweetened foods for a number of reasons. Fruits and vegetables, on the other hand, are different. If you chew them enough, it's still okay to eat all of the fresh fruits and vegetables you want, even if they are high on the glycemic index. So let's cut to the chase and give you some general recommendations concerning your diet. First, clean up your act. Eliminate as much of the processed and cooked food from your diet as possible. Instead of canned or frozen, eat fresh. Eliminate as much of the refined flours, grains, and sugars as possible. Instead of white bread, eat real whole wheat bread. Instead of cake and ice cream for dessert, eat fruit. Replace low-value foods, such as potatoes and iceberg lettuce, with high-value foods, such as sweet potatoes and almost any of the richly colored vegetables, particularly spinach, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, and beets. Note, for those with arthritis, it might be useful to forgo vegetables from the nightshade family, including tomatoes, spinach, and eggplant. As much as possible, eliminate all snack foods and fast foods. Replace with prunes. No kidding. Prunes are extremely powerful antioxidants. Replace with raisins, all of the berries. Eliminate all hydrogenated oils and trans fatty acids. Replace with olive oil and fresh butter. Cut back on the quantity of meat, chicken, dairy, and pork in your diet. And no, pork is not the other white meat. And make sure that what you do consume is organic. Incidentally, pesticide levels are far more concentrated in the animal flesh and dairy that we eat than in the fruits and vegetables sprayed with those pesticides. Think about this for a moment. The animals consume these pesticides day after day, steadily concentrating all of the pesticides they eat through their entire lives in their flesh. The bottom line is the higher up the food chain you go, the more concentrated the pesticides are. A cow eats hundreds of pounds of clover to make a few gallons of milk, concentrating the pesticides in that milk. Then again, it takes 21 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of butter and 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese, concentrating the pesticides even more. As for fish, fish, of course, is okay. Okay, that is, if you can be sure it's free of heavy metals and toxins and hormonal modifications. So what does that leave you? Actually, thousands of choices. Virtually everything that we've talked about eliminating is easily replaced with a healthier version. If you can't find the organic meats and dairy you want or the whole grain foods you're looking for, talk to your supermarket. In most cases, they will get it for you if you ask. Of course, if someone is in an advanced state of illness, they'd better clean up their act totally and eat no meat and no cooked food. In fact, ideally, they should go on a raw juice fast at least until they get well. We'll talk more about fasting later. Anyway, once you're well, You can bake up a potato or grill yourself a nice piece of organic beef if that's your bent. The bottom line, though, is that the worse you eat, the more often you will need to cleanse and detox and make use of supplements. Let me repeat that. The worse you eat, the more often you will need to cleanse and detox and make use of supplements. Now, final thing to cover here. What do I personally eat? Everyone wants to know, what do you personally eat? Well, at one time, I was totally vegetarian, primarily for ethical reasons. Anyone who has any awareness of how cattle, poultry, and pigs are treated in our modern super farms must think twice about consuming products produced by this system. It is incredibly cruel. Unfortunately, after years of speaking engagements in numerous places around the world, I got tired of eating iceberg lettuce with second-rate Italian dressings for lunch and white rice and dead vegetables for dinners. I broke down and started eating small amounts of chicken and fish again. My diet now consists of fresh juices, superfoods, and ground flaxseed for breakfast. Large fresh salads with a variety of greens and vegetables, with the occasional small piece of chicken or fish for lunch, and sometimes I'll substitute a plate of lightly steamed, baked, or stir-fried vegetables for the salad. Dinner is light, sometimes a bowl of low-temperature, cooked whole-grain cereal so the enzymes are still active, sometimes a small bowl of soup, sometimes fresh fruit, etc. On the other hand, I still have an occasional slice of pizza. When I was young, I'd eat pizza 2 to 3 times a week. Now it's once a month. And more often than I should, I still indulge a sweet tooth and have a dessert. Well, that's it for our discussion of diet. In our next talk, part 6 in the series, we'll cover the organic issue in detail and lay out for you the whole story on using supplements.